Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, we've got this week's reinvention story, and we'll hear from Community Voices producer Renee Wild. University of Dayton professor Bob Brekka is back with a commentary on climate change, and reporter Lewis Wallace will talk with Juliet Fromholtz about how Indian Ripple Road got its name. That's the subject of this month's Why So Curious. Up first, the musical instruments recently on display downtown are gone, and after 75 years, the old Hauer Music Store is mostly empty, but not for long. As early as mid-May, construction crews will begin renovating the building, making it ready for about 50 Dayton Metro Library employees. On Wednesday, the library opened up the doors to the building on Patterson Boulevard in downtown Dayton so employees could see where they'll be working next year. As part of a major system-wide reorganization and renovation project for Dayton Metro, the historic building will become the library system's operations center. David Slifkin, director of the downtown library, says it'll be a big change for the employees moving there.
Those who will be here permanently are very excited to be here. It'll be our operations center, it'll be our technical services, our human resources, our IT departments, and training and development.
The operations center will occupy the second, third, and fourth floors of the building, and in 2015, when renovations to the 3rd Street branch begin, many of the books will be temporarily relocated to the first floor of the operations center. Library officials say that space could eventually be leased out. Renovations should begin as early as next week, and Community Engagement Manager Jane Close says plans are to keep as much of the building's historical look as possible.
Where there's exposed brick, just clean it up. Obviously, where it's already painted, we'll have to give it a fresh coat of paint. And then we'll be taking out the current stair tower on the north side and building a new stair tower to meet current needs for elevators and so forth.
Renovations are expected to be completed in February of 2015. This spring, new student achievement tests based on standards known as Common Core are getting their first test drive in many school districts throughout Ohio. The standards, which emphasize analytical thinking over rote memorization, were developed by educational professionals from around the country. They were rolled out in 2010, and the resulting new Common Core assessments are now in field testing stage. State Impact Ohio's Bill Rice dropped in on a Lorain City school in Northeast Ohio to find out how they've fared testing the tests.
There's two ways you can solve for this. One way.
With her first encounter with the new Common Core assessment behind her, Lorain math teacher Kristen Mackey is back in the classroom doing what comes as second nature to her, jotting numbers and drawing graphs on the dry erase board, working through problems with her students.
So we can have 7 minus negative 5 over 4 minus negative 6. What happens to your double negatives? Positive. So you're going to end up with a positive 12 over positive 10. Now, Brianna,
Mackey teaches 8th grade math and algebra at Longfellow Middle School. She says there was some frustration a few weeks back as she and her students navigated their way through this year's Common Core assessment field test. It's a dry run to expose the bugs in the system so they can be worked out by next year when the results will actually count. Mackey suggests it's worth doing.
We need to get some glitches out, especially on the technology end.
The tests were developed by PARC, the Partnership for the Assessment of Readiness for College and Careers, based in Washington, D.C. It's developing Common Core assessments for 16 states, including Ohio, that have fully adopted the new standards. The tests are fully web-based, and Mark Evans, Director of Data and Accountability for Lorain City Schools, says putting the technological infrastructure in place was a challenge.
That's one of the biggest struggles that districts and Lorain was having. We were fortunate that we were able to leverage some of our grant funding in order to get iPads and laptop and computers for our students to use this that were efficient enough and met the requirements and specs.
But there certainly were some glitches. Evan says some students had trouble just accessing the test. That was due mostly to lack of bandwidth, which caused computers attempting to log into PARC servers to time out. One class had its test postponed for a day. Those problems were ultimately overcome, but it was still a rocky experience for many students. Kristen Mackey says many of hers found the digital format difficult to maneuver, unlike the current Ohio Achievement Assessment, which the PARC exam will replace starting next year.
They have their question at the very top, and they had to keep scrolling down, scrolling up. They couldn't see the math question in front of them like they can on the regular OAA, where it's paper and pencil right in front of them. It was constant scrolling, learning how to use the tools. There was a graphing calculator on there, which we don't use.
Eighth grade English teacher Jennifer George says her students had similar experiences.
We teach them close reading skills when you're looking for answers and highlighting and starring things, and they were having trouble using the tools to do that.
And I talked to several eighth grade students who confirmed they found the tests frustrating. Haviland Murray says it's a big change from the paper and pencil tests that she's used to.
The PARC test is all on computers with all these fancy gadgets and what you have it's on it. And I just feel it's overwhelming, stressful, and the computers aren't that reliable.
PARC CEO Laura Slover says without a doubt there will be a learning curve and transition period during which students, teachers, and administrators will become more familiar with the Common Core assessment. And she says comments like those we've heard from Lorraine are not unexpected. PARC will be collecting and processing them, along with reams of other data from hundreds of school districts over the coming months.
The field test is a big research study, essentially, and it enables us to know that when we go into the field next year with the first operational test, the test is going to work as planned, is high quality, and we can deliver reliable and valid results.
Teacher Kristen Mackey says despite the technical glitches and students' frustrations, she fully supports moving ahead with implementing the Common Core.
The test kind of reminds me of how I teach. I have very high expectations of all my students, and I don't lower them. And I think our teaching needs to adapt to the test a little bit, and we need to change how we're explaining things and our wording.
Everyone, students and teachers, will make the adjustment, she says. It just won't happen overnight. For State Impact Ohio, I'm Bill Rice.
In other state news, the first new memorial in decades on the Statehouse grounds is just a few weeks away from being completed. Statehouse correspondent Karen Kassler checked in with those who've been working on bringing the project to Capitol Square.
Workers are sanding and drilling long pieces of grayish-white stone in a pit on the south lawn of the Statehouse, in the shadow of two big metal structures that look like ladders. Right now, the Holocaust and Liberators Memorial doesn't look much like the artist's rendering that's posted on the fence surrounding it. However, Joyce Garver Keller with Ohio Jewish Community says it'll soon take shape. The stone is there, and soon 18-foot-tall bronze panels that will be assembled to form a cutout of a split Star of David on those metal ladders will arrive.
That work was done off-site, and that will be brought in and placed on the memorial site. And the stonework, which was quarried outside of Cleveland, and so everything should be in place for the dedication.
Garver Keller says this technically will be the second Holocaust memorial at a state house. There's one on the grounds of the Capitol in Des Moines, Iowa. But she says this memorial is unique because it honors not just those who lost their lives, but also those who saved lives. As noted by the phrase from the Jewish text, the Talmud, that's carved into the stone of the memorial, if you save one life, it's as if you saved the world.
Seeing that, I think will give people pause. That we'll think about it. It may bring discussion together in terms of a work of art. Art should provoke conversation and thought, and I think that this piece will do that in a very positive way.
And Garver Keller says she thinks the Holocaust and Liberators Memorial will also draw attention and study to the State House's other memorials and statues. Bad weather this winter had delayed construction of the memorial, but the $2.3 million project, paid for with private funds and constructed with $300,000 worth of taxpayer-funded work on the site, is set to be dedicated in what is planned to be a large and elaborate ceremony on June 2nd. Karen Kassler at the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau.
You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. Today on Reinvention Stories, we make a final visit to Trotwood to meet Jason and Angela Shelton. They were both teachers who decided to reinvent themselves as small business owners. WYSO's Juliette Fromholt has their story.
Jason Shelton was the band director for Trotwood Madison High School, and his wife Angela was a preschool teacher. Jason wanted to become a personal trainer with his own fitness center, and Angela wanted to open a daycare center. They had both dreamed of becoming entrepreneurs for years, but the decision to leave steady jobs didn't come easily. Angela says a Sunday morning sermon helped push them forward.
It seemed like the message was just for us, because we were on the ropes, like, should we? I was on this side, Jason was on that side, but we were kind of in the middle. But once we heard that sermon, it was like, that's it. This is what you need. And after that, it was no more questioning. It was just a matter of moving forward with it.
Well, we're going to hit the ass with the boxing. Okay,
my glove?
Yes, ma'am.
Last summer, Jason opened Perfect 10 Fitness, a small gym near the Old Salem Mall in Trotwood. His first clients were friends and former students, but word about the business spread quickly, and Jason began getting more walk-ins. He says his focus is on wellness, not just working out, and he likes being able to give his clients individual attention.
We're not a large gym, so you don't have 100 people in the gym trying to do the same thing, 100 people looking at you while you're doing your workouts. So as you see, while I was training, it's just us. And you know what I'm saying? So you get that one-on-one attention. You know that person is focusing on you.
Jason was off to a strong start. And Angela told me that even their kids were enjoying watching their parents' progress.
At first, they were a little skeptic, like, you both are leaving your jobs and you're both doing something brand new. But now that they see it coming to life, they're really excited about it. They talk about it probably more than we do, so it's good.
But even though Jason's business was doing well, by mid-year, Angela's daycare center was moving along more slowly because of the complex permit process on the state and county level.
Good try.
On the day before Easter, the Shelton family cheers on their oldest daughter in a soccer game. The long winter meant more delays in Angela's daycare business.
I'm even kind of trying to decide. I don't have very much time whether I'm really wanting to pursue that anymore. But so everything is at a standstill. We have the place. We have materials. It's just a matter of getting those things and then me making my decision. I feel like a high school student fresh out of college. I don't know what I want to do with my life. I thought I wanted to do this. So I've really been praying about it, and I'm trying to stand still and wait on God to give me some answers on the directions that I need to go.
Angela says she's grateful that the delays have allowed her to stay home with her son, something she didn't get to do with her daughters because she had to work. But Jason's business is doing well enough to sustain the family.
We're to the point where we have so many clients, we actually have to put people on waiting lists now. Yeah, a lot of people, they want to train. A lot of people are getting their minds right as far as being healthy.
Jason's hard work building his business has paid off, and he's looking forward to his second year of operation and beyond. He has some big ideas for how to keep growing his business, but for right now, he's happy to celebrate how far he's come by taking a chance on opening the gym.
If you focus on trying to change a lot of things at one time, that's where you're going to fail. But if you make one change with something small, then you have succeeded.
For WYSO, I'm Juliette Frumholt.
You can see a short film about Jason and Angela produced by filmmaker Chandra Jones on our website, wyso.org. Major funding for the second season of Reinvention Stories comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation with support from Wright State University, Celia Fund, the Yellow Springs Community Foundation, and Antioch College. Spring is roofing season. Time to check your roof for damage it may have sustained during the winter. Near the banks of the Great Miami River in Dayton, a man is making an unusual roof this spring using materials that most people would never consider. Community Voices producer Renee Wild has our story.
Tucked between a busy interstate and a pair of train tracks lies a prehistoric site called the Sunwatch Indian Village. And in that recreated village, something unusual is going on. an Irishman is keeping a Native American tradition alive.
You got a system going.
Yeah, we did it.
You're making them into sheaves, shapes.
William Cahill lives in Cincinnati and has a skill set only one other person in the United States shares. He's a master thatcher.
Yes, my wife says you're working in a, you know, in a trade that's back in the dark ages, you know, from the dark ages, you know.
Today, William is working on a structure called the Solstice House. Also with him is Bill Kennedy, an archaeologist and curator of anthropology for the Dayton Society of Natural History. They are harvesting and bundling sheaves of native grasses to use in creating an authentic thatched roof. So just how does one become a master thatcher?
I did an apprenticeship back in Ireland for about 5 years. And after I left school, so I'm in it over 30 years now, so I am doing the roof and the false arts. So I think I like the outdoors and being my own boss.
Thatching may not be the most popular roofing choice in today's U.S. homes, but chances are your ancestors had one. Here's archaeologist Bill Kennedy.
All peoples in the world have generally used some form of thatch at one point in their history. So unless you are a full-blooded Eskimo, no matter who you are, some, if not most, of your ancestors at some point lived under thatch.
Living in harmony with nature is an important part of William's work. He practices a sustainable harvesting of the grasses used in the thatching process. And at places like Sunwatch, he is able to actually harvest native grass on site.
We're going into the field here at Sunwatch, and they have Indian grass and bluestem.
William's thatched roofs are durable and weathertight, naturally warm in the winter and cool in the summer, and absolutely beautiful to look at.
You know, the colors are all these natural, I would call them yellowish, going fading to brown to sort of light grays in some of them, depending where they've been exposed. You know, while we were out harvesting and had left some of the material, and there's a nice weathered look to some of it, but yet it's very vibrant when it's first put up there, so it is, and there's a spring to it.
And it smells fantastic.
It does.
As William was working, he was approached by Justin Houston, a local man of Cherokee descent. He came to ask advice from the master thatcher.
I've seen some of William's work at some of the other parks at Fort Ancient, and he does some real good work. And I do a lot of the same work.
William is on the road an average of 250 days a year, creating structures for museums, zoos, and private residences. He's even created one for Martha Stewart. As we stood inside the Solstice House, admiring William's work, he said it's hard, but it has its rewards.
You feel good inside, you know, most of the time on it. You know, I would have to say it really is satisfying, so it is.
You're tired, but it's a good kind of tired.
Yes, it's a physical, so it is on it, but you're awake.
Yes. Yes.
You know what I mean? You're alive, so
yes.
You are, and you know it.
But your hands aren't as gnarly as I thought that they would be. Although, did you break your finger at one point?
I've done some, you know, knife wounds, you know, from cutting and making the stitches.
It's got to be incredibly satisfying to know that those hands made that.
It is. You know, that's the beauty about my job, is the fact that there's great satisfaction at the start and at the end. I've often said on jobs that if I can't go back and have a cup of tea with them, no matter how good the job has been, I'll have failed.
Are you going to have a cup of tea with them at the end?
Yes.
We have many cups of tea daily.
We have many cups of tea.
I'm a coffee man, but I'm getting into tea.
But
he's turning me.
I'm Renee Wild for WYSO Radio.
You're listening to WYSO Weekend on 91.3 FM WYSO. And thanks for joining us online at WYSO.org. I'm Jerry Kenny. Coming up next, WYSO Curious.
Lewis Wallace, a reporter here at WISO and the creator of our series, Why So Curious? You submit questions and curiosities about the Miami Valley, and WISO reporters answer them. We've gotten so many great questions already, and the latest we were able to investigate came from a listener named Converse Griffith, who asked how Indian Ripple Road in the Beaver Creek Kettering area got its name. Webmaster Juliette Frumholt took on that question, and she's here to talk about what she found. Let's start with what you found out about the story behind the word Indian in the name Indian Ripple Road.
Well, the Indian refers to the native people that lived along the Little Miami River in primarily, we're talking the 17th century, but going back much, much further than that. While the Little Miami is named for the Miami Indian tribe, the actual tribe that we're referring to when we talk about the Indian in Indian Ripple is the Shawnee. They were famously led by Tecumseh, another one of those names that you hear a lot in the Miami Valley. And they made their home right there along the Little Miami River. They would have been spending a lot of time traveling through the area where the road is now, going back and forth from their settlement in Old Town, just north of Xenia, to some of their more southern settlements.
And then what's a ripple or a riffle?
Well, a riffle is actually a geological feature. It is a characteristic of a river. In a river, you typically have riffles and runs. And a riffle is an area in which there is a shallow water, but the water's moving very quickly over the rocks, but you're still getting the tops of the rocks cresting over the water, as opposed to a run where the water is completely covering all of the rocks.
And Indian Ripple Road used to be Indian Riffle Road, so it sounds like it's safe to assume that that name in some way relates to a riffle. Is there a particular riffle? Is there an Indian riffle?
Well, we don't know for sure in modern times. There is a book in the Greene County Public Library's Greene County Room that features an illustration of the Indian riffle. It's from 1908, and it was done by John Davidson. And it actually accompanies an essay, also written in 1908, about the people that lived, the native people that lived along the Little Miami River, the Shawnee, and some of the tribes that they were trading with and warring with. In modern times, we don't know what the Indian Riffle is or where it is, in part because the makeup of the land has changed so much over the years. But you can see a lot of examples of riffles in the Narrows Nature Preserve right there along the Little Miami.
And this road has changed a lot. Take us through some of that history that you found.
Well, it started off as an agricultural road. It would have been used by the various landowners that lived along that stretch in Greene County. It wasn't paved until the 40s, until about 1940, and that's when it really came into formal usage. And you start to see the name right there at the beginning of the 20th century. But still, even in the 20th century, you see some route changes. The Old Road Trail in the Narrows Nature Preserve is actually a part of the road that was rerouted in the 20th century. And then all the way up to 1999, there was another reroute done right at the intersection of Indian Ripple and North Fairfield Road to try to improve the safety of the traffic patterns there.
So we understand Indian, we understand Riffle, we have an idea of where the name came from, but it's not quite pinned down as to who named it and when.
When we set out on this question, it seems like something that we ought to know. And a lot of the historians and librarians I consulted actually agreed. They said, wow, we're really surprised that no one has sort of put all of the disparate research together to find this information. And this conclusion that we've come to through our investigation is the closest I can find, at least, of sort of piecing all of these different pieces of information together as far as the maps and the illustrations and looking at the people and the geology and then just the development of the road.
Thank you, Juliette.
Thanks, Lewis.
WISO reporter and webmaster Juliette Frumholt investigated how Indian Ripple Road got its name for Why So Curious. That's our series about your curiosity. You ask the questions and we explore online and on the radio. Got something you're curious about? Submit a question at WYSO.org and stay tuned for more right here on 91.3 FM. For WYSO, I'm Lewis Wallace.
When thinking about how much we're willing to do to prevent climate change, University of Dayton professor Bob Brekka wonders if we worry too much about economics alone.
Questions and comments often come up when I start talking about renewable energy. They go something like this. I would like to install solar panels, but the payback time is just too long. Or when I bought a hybrid car 10 years ago, friends said, that's nice, but how long will it take for gas savings to make up for the extra cost? On the face of it, there's nothing wrong with those questions. In fact, economists tell us that we are rational, alert, information processing machines. But the reality is that we don't behave like that at all in most of our daily lives. Maybe we need to imagine questions about energy a bit differently. Why does someone buy a BMW or a Lexus instead of a Chevy? It certainly isn't financially rational. Luxury cars cost more than other models, and you lose $10,000 in value just driving the BMW off the dealer's lot. How long does it take for the difference in cost between a BMW and a cheaper car to pay off? Or for the choice to get a nicer stereo system in your Ford? If you choose a marble countertop or a fancy oven for the kitchen in your home, will that have a payback? We do many things in life simply because we want to. The payback is our immediate pleasure, not dollars. We seem to hold renewable energy and other energy-efficient technologies to a much higher standard, whereas, in fact, they do pay off financially, even if it takes some time. What we need to do is start recognizing the pleasure that comes with knowing that our electricity or hot water is coming from the sun shining on our roof, or that energy-efficient appliances and cars are helping the environment. The fact that we can also save money in the long run is an added benefit. For WYSO, I'm Bob Brekka.
Bob Brekka is a professor of physics and renewable and clean energy. He is the coordinator of the Sustainability, Energy, and the Environment program at the University of Dayton. For more stories and commentaries, visit our website, wyso.org.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the third week of late spring. When Torricelli invented the mercury barometer in 1644, he gave a novel gauge to the world of meteorological medicine. A decrease in atmospheric pressure, the calm before the storm, had been associated with pain since the Golden Age of Greece. Theophrastus, one of Plato's students, knew that if the feet swell, there will be a change to the south wind. Theophrastus understood without a barometer what Dr. Clarence Mills claimed to discover almost a century ago. Mills was an Ohio physician who hypothesized that the history of the whole world could be explained by highs and lows in temperature and barometric pressure. Theophrastus thought hurricanes could be foretold by a shooting pain in the right foot. Dr. Mills theorized that such discomfort might indeed be related to dropping barometric pressure. In addition, claimed the Ohio doctor, people subject to severe headaches or fainting spells most often have their attacks when the barometer is falling. Attempts at suicide are then much more likely to occur as well. People are more forgetful at those times, too, he suggested. And they're less able to concentrate. Traffic and industrial accidents increase, and not of least importance, childbirths multiply. But when the north wind blows, when fair weather and a rising barometer are standing by as your allies, then, Mills declared, it is time to prepare your most complex proposals and attack your most difficult problems. And, to double the beneficial barometric effect, he explained one should do all this on the mornings of rising pressure days, when, to the favorable weather, there is added the barometer's daily climb from its post-midnight low. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the fourth week of late spring. In the meantime, of course, check the barometer. See if Theophrastus and Dr. Mills are right.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide.
including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at WYSO.org.
That's it for this week's edition of WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at WYSO.org. WYSO is a community service of Antioch College for the Miami Valley and beyond. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks for listening. Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook.
This week on American Roots, we plumb the colorful convergence of art and music. Richie Havens tells about his first gig in the Village, and it wasn't strumming a guitar. Then conversation with 60s pop artist Peter Max, plus a visit to the poster mecca, Nashville's Hat Show Print. I'm Nick Spitzer. Join me for music and art on American Roots from PRX.
Tune into American Roots this afternoon at 2 on WYSO.